The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A little more than a year ago, panic over the Ebola virus reached its peak. Now the mosquito-borne Zika virus has public officials shuddering and scientists scrambling to come up with vaccines and treatments. The head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control now acknowledges that Zika is, quote, scarier than we originally thought. Yes, it is scary, and fear gets the media and the public's attention. Meanwhile, there are far less attention-grabbing pathogens you've likely never heard of that could potentially be more dangerous to humans. Ed Yong is a science writer for The Atlantic, where he wrote about a virus that is killing off large numbers of a fish called tilapia, and why it and other diseases may have dangerous implications for the future of our food supply. We reached Ed in London via Skype. Ed, welcome to the program.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, let's start with tilapia. How big is the global demand for this particular fish?
Right, so tilapia is, I think, the second most heavily farmed fish in the world. It's very easy to grow. The fish will basically eat anything. And as a result, it's become the core of this $7.5 billion aquaculture industry. It's really important for the developing world as a source of protein, but for the developed world too. So America is the world's leading importer of tilapia, and you guys eat about 225,000 tons of the fish every year.
So now tilapia have been discovered dying off in huge numbers in the Sea of Galilee. Why?
Right. So in 2005, this dying tilapia was discovered in Israel, and other such outbreaks have been found in Ecuador and Colombia, so across the Atlantic Ocean. And in both cases, the cause is the same. It's a newly discovered virus that has been called TILV, or tilapia lake virus.
How does the virus affect the fish?
So the virus affects their behavior. It makes them sluggish. It causes their skin to redden and develop these lesions, and it causes inflammation of the eyes. And some symptoms vary from place to place. So the Israeli version of the virus seems to be targeting the brain. Whereas the ones in South America cause more problems for the liver. But either way, it seems to be causing a lot of deaths among tilapia, huge proportions of stocks, both in farms and in natural sources like the Sea of Galilee, have started dying.
Is it affecting other types of fish?
It seems to be very specific to tilapia. So there are other fish in the Sea of Galilee, but they don't seem to be dying en masse to the same degree.
So how much, Ed, of the current supply of tilapia has been lost to this mysterious illness?
It sort of varies a lot from place to place and from year to year. So when the dying fish were first discovered in Israel about 10 years ago, farmers were losing maybe a third of their stock. In some cases, they've lost up to, you know, much greater proportions. So the majority of the fish have been lost. So it sort of goes up and down, but it seems to be a persisting problem.
This is a fish that has been around for thousands of years. So what has changed? Where did this virus come from?
Yeah, it's really interesting. No one really knows because it is only so recently discovered. It's likely that it's a much older virus than we think, just based on the fact that it was recently discovered. It may have been around for a long time, but only started killing fish recently because we've started breeding tilapia in such high numbers, at such high densities. We've created conditions where TILV and other similar viruses of livestock and fish and plant crops can emerge, when new virulent strains of these diseases and these pathogens can start becoming a problem.
All right. So you mentioned in the Middle East, Sea of Galilee initially, Ecuador, Colombia, spreading not just among farm tilapia, but also wild tilapia. So what do you do? I mean, what is the plan to save tilapia from a virus that it's pretty difficult to isolate?
We know so little about the virus already. You know, clearly it's gone global before anyone even knew that it existed. And weirder still, it seems to belong to a branch of the virus family tree that we know almost nothing about. So it looks almost totally unlike any virus that we knew of before. There's a little bit of it that looks a little bit like a type of influenza virus that causes cold symptoms in humans, but it's a very remote resemblance. This virus doesn't infect humans at all. It just seems to hint at this hidden world of viruses that we knew nothing about, and that in itself is very worrying. You know, who knows what other members of that family are out there, whether they have the potential to affect animals and plants that we rely on for food, and in the meantime, there's this tilapia virus that we still need to study. So hopefully, the idea is that by learning more about its biology, we'll be able to develop vaccines that can be injected into tilapia to stop the spread of this pathogen, or at least control it to some degree.
Has that ever been done before, vaccines for a fish?
So the same team that discovered this tilapia virus identified a virus that was killing farmed salmon about 6 years ago, and they're on the path to developing a vaccine for that. And you know, these things are not unprecedented, but I think we can expect more such problems to rear their head in the future, as it, just because of our farming and aquaculture practices.
Well, I'm sure you've heard of Ebola and the Zika virus and even bird flu and other foodborne illnesses. Well, how about the tilapia lake virus, which is wiping out schools of tilapia? It's a fish that the U.S. consumes to the tune of 225,000 tons a year, and it feeds people all over the developing world. We're finding out more about the virus and its implications for the future of our food supply. Well, I want to talk to you more about that because you point to a much bigger reality of our global food system that makes food supply more vulnerable. How is that connected to what's going on with tilapia now?
So, you know, tilapia is just one species that we rely on for food. There are many other animals, and they've also had emerging diseases crop up recently, older diseases that have emerged in new strains and variants. And, you know, in terms of the plants that we depend on, I wrote a piece about plant diseases about 3 years ago for a magazine called Aeon, and I was shocked to learn that something like 90% of the world's calories come from just 15 crops, things like rice and wheat, things that we plant in highly inbred monocultures over large areas of land. And that creates exactly the types of conditions where virulent pathogens might evolve and emerge. And there's precedent for diseases of plants in particular causing huge social upheavals and massive problems. You know, these things will cause famine. Potato blight is a fungus that destroyed a lot of potato crops in Ireland, creating huge economic upheaval and global upheaval as migrants spread to other corners of the world. These diseases can have huge global impacts, and I think it's shocking not just the potential for harm, but how relatively unconcerned we are about diseases of, say, livestock or fish or plant crops.
No, of course. I mean, you make this point, you know, that a pathogen among fish does not grab the kind of attention, certainly as, you know, a virus wiping out people in West Africa or birth defects in Brazil. But at the same time, people can choose to say, I'm not going to eat tilapia, or they don't pay attention because I don't like fish, you know. So
it's true.
So why then, Ed, do you feel like we need to sound the alarm about this now?
I think the fact is that every species that we rely on for food is in danger of some kind of pathogen, and that danger will only grow over time. So, you know, you could say, yes, I could avoid tilapia, or I could cut back on meat, but I can't cut back on meat and fish and vegetables. I have to eat something, and there's nothing that we rely on for food that is impervious to the ravages of disease. And I think if we don't take these problems seriously, it is entirely possible that our food supplies will take a huge hit in the future. And, you know, our bodies may succumb to diseases like Ebola or flu, but our bodies also need food, and our food supplies are equally vulnerable. And I think that is something that we aren't concerned enough about. There aren't enough scientists working on those problems. They don't get enough funding from grant agencies. When something like bird flu potentially jumps from poultry to humans, we get panicked. We worry a lot, but we don't really care when it's killing millions of chickens that we need to eat. So I think that there needs to be more of an emphasis on diseases that affect the things that the animals and plants that we need in order to survive. You know, famine is a horseman of the apocalypse just as much as pestilence is, and the two of them do ride hand in hand.
Well, Ed, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Ed Yong, he's a science writer for The Atlantic. That's where we found his article, The Scary Thing About a Virus That Kills Farmed Fish. He also writes a blog for Nat Geo called Not Exactly Rocket Science. And his first book, I Contain Multitudes, which looks into how microbes influence the lives of every animal, is due out later this year. We've got links to all of that at wordofmouthradio.org. The shaky state of tilapia aside, the fish trade is thriving in markets across the world. Rachel Solomon brings us this audio postcard from Seattle's iconic Pike Place Market, where the enthusiasm is tangible and the fish are flying.
Ryan Rector digs into the ice, grips a 3-foot salmon, and hurls it behind him. His coworker catches it. The crowd erupts into cheers. It's a typical day at work for Rector, a fishmonger at Seattle's Pike Place Fish Market. The market is world famous for its seafood acrobatics, drawing thousands of customers and spectators each day. Most come just to watch the fish fly.
I have a really great job. I get to meet lots of people and generally in pretty pleasant moods. And I like to have a good, hardworking craft but still be in the city.
And so throwing fish around all day is, well, kind of fun. Sure, this high-flying seafood shop is something of a tourist trap, but the locals like it too. Seattle resident Dana already knows how she's going to prepare her sockeye salmon.
We're going to put a little salt and pepper on it and grill it, and that's it. A little lemon off the table, a glass of Chardonnay, loaf of bread, maybe a Caesar salad.
The market has inspired books and TV shows with its service-driven business model. The employees are all smiles all the time. They joke with customers and pose for photos as they shout back orders for fresh mussels and Dungeness crab legs. But when you're throwing giant fish around, someone's bound to get hit. One guy asked Ryan Rector to hit him for a YouTube video he was filming. Then there was the woman who actually hugged Rector after he accidentally struck her with a trout.
She was actually all the way over at the meat market, and somebody ordered 26 rainbow trout. And they wouldn't let me walk them up. They made me throw all of them. So at the end, I tried to do like my best baseball pitch and strike the guy out. Unfortunately, I did strike him out. And it flew all the way over to the next stand and hit a woman in the back with the trout. So.
Even in the rain and the cold, people hover around the market, breath bated and cameras poised. Some customers tote fish back home to Canada, Texas, or even as far as Thailand. Because here in Seattle, playing with your food isn't just allowed. It's tradition. From Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon.
Down here for the fish is happy, as off through the waves they roll. The fish on the land ain't happy, they shot cause they in the bowl. But fish in the bowl is lucky, they in for a worse of fate. One day when the boss get hungry,
yes, who go beyond the pay.
But oh, under the sea, under the sea. Nobody beat us, fry us, and eat us.
Coming up, Russian history and nationalism are on full display in Moscow's Red Square, where sites include St. Basil's Cathedral, the Kremlin, and most intriguingly, Lenin's mausoleum, where mourners line up to view the corpse of the revolutionary leader. But keeping Lenin looking fresh requires quite a bit of expensive effort. We'll learn more after a short break when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A must-see for any visitor to Russia is Moscow's Red Square, home to the iconic St. Basil's Cathedral, the Kremlin Wall, and Lenin's Mausoleum, a macabre attraction where the embalmed corpse of the communist leader has been on display since shortly after his death in 1924. Not surprisingly, maintaining the freshness of a man who died that long ago is no easy feat and requires great care and money. Marina Corin wrote about the process in an article for The Atlantic called The Cost of Keeping Lenin Looking Like Lenin. And Marina, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
I just can't waste your terrific opening line for this. Vladimir Lenin's body is nearly 146 years old, but doesn't look a day over 53.
That's very true. He is somehow like a fine wine. He gets better with age, but a lot of work goes into making sure that he does.
How much does it cost the Russian government to keep Lenin looking like that?
Well, this year is going to cost up to 13 million rubles, which is about $198,000. So it's not very cheap. And it's going to be funded by the government. And the government has funded Lenin's preservation up until the Soviet Union broke apart. After that, they relied on private donations. But more recently, and probably because the current Russian president, Vladimir Putin, is very supportive of keeping Lenin on display, the government has begun funding his preservation again.
You said this year. Do they do this every year?
They do. So every other year, they take the corpse off of display and start this weeks-long, very complicated process. Like, you know, at the end of the day, this is a mummified body, but not when you hear mummification, you think of, you know, the way the Egyptians did it. And that's not what this process is like. This is a process that has been fine-tuned over decades. And you have a team of scientists working on it. You have anatomists, biochemists, and surgeons. And every other year, they take Lenin's body off display for a couple of weeks and basically give the body a fresh coat of embalming fluids. Yeah, they just submerge the body in these various solutions, and it's really painstaking work.
After so many years, does the embalming fluid still do the job? What else do they have to do?
Well, so there's not as much biological and organic material left in Lenin's body as there was, you know, when he died back in the 1920s. His original eyelashes, for example, have been replaced by artificial ones. Historians have written that in 1945, a piece of skin on Lenin's foot went missing. And so researchers had to develop some kind of artificial skin to replace that piece. So much of what you see, I mean, it definitely looks very lifelike, but it's not, most of it is not real.
I'm assuming the Lenin on display is fully clothed. Does it matter that a piece of his foot? I'm sorry to say this to, you know, a man who holds a great place in history, but can they not just sort of fake what's going on underneath?
No, and I don't think that that's the Russian way. They're going to definitely go all in when they're preserving this, the body of this person who's so influential to their history. And there's a great deal of nostalgia attached for many Russians about those times and the kind of leader that he was. And so I believe he gets, you know, a fresh change of clothes every now and then. So even the clothes are very important, too, what he's wearing and making sure that the fabric is maintained as well.
It's interesting that he still holds such an important place in Russian thought. I mean, during the Soviet era, certainly there were very long lines to visit the tomb. Does it still draw crowds?
It doesn't draw as many people as it once did, and that's the argument that some Russians make for giving Lenin a proper burial. And in fact, Russian-run polls, Russian state-run polls, have shown that the majority of Russians want him to just quietly be put into the ground like everyone else. Because they do see the mausoleum as now being just this tourist attraction. It's not something that was sacred as it was in the past. But Putin has been very adamant about it staying put. And you know, he tends to idealize elements of the Soviet past, like many other Russians. And he's likened the mausoleum to the way that Russians display relics of Orthodox saints in monasteries. So this isn't just, you know, a mummy.
Well, and obviously when you're talking about tourist attractions, it's not just the Russians, it's other people. Is this a moneymaker for Russia?
That's a good question. And I wonder how much the government does get from that. But how many other places in the world, I think there are very few where you can go and see a former world leader, for lack of a better word, chillin' right in front of you. So I imagine that foreign observers are very fascinated by this and are drawn to it.
Marina Korin, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Marina Korin, senior associate editor for The Atlantic. She wrote about the cost of keeping Lenin looking like Lenin. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Taxidermy is not unusual, especially in rural communities where hunting is a way of life, like parts of the Midwest. What is more unusual is preserving bodies of, say, a three-headed squirrel or a chimera. Those are some of the pieces Serena Brewer has created over her long career as a taxidermist. A passionate animal lover, Serena has found a way to honor them by reimagining their corpses in creative ways. But this fantastical rogue taxidermy is not for everyone. This segment was produced by Lila Chernoff, and it does contain some real noises from the process.
Artist Serena Brewer's studio could belong to any sculptor. There's a tidy workbench with scissors, knives, and pruning shears arranged neatly nearby.
So here we are in my studio.
And then your eyes fall on the thawing carcass of a small mammal. And you know you're somewhere else.
Oh yeah, we're skinning a squirrel.
That's Serena Brewer. She's the woman credited with starting an art movement called Rogue Taxidermy.
We're cutting where his little whiskers are attached.
Brewer's in her mid-40s. She has straight red hair and a pale complexion. She sports fashionable eyeglasses right on the brim of her nose.
When I am working with animals, it's almost like sometimes a certain animal is speaking to me and telling me like what wants to be used for next. That probably sounds kind of corny to some people, but I guess you could really liken that to like some like a potter working with clay. And they will say when you touch a lump of clay, how it tells you how it wants to be shaped or formed. And that's kind of how I feel too. And then what I'll do is I'll remove the head on this so that I can just have the skull.
Brewer is well known for her mythological taxidermy. There's the Goth Griffin, which she made using the body of a black cat attached to the arched wings and piercing head of a crow.
Can't use eagles or lions, so.
There's the Capricorn, which she created using the scaly tail of a fish attached to the shoulders and head of a baby goat. And then there's a crouching monkey in a fez hat clutching a martini glass. That one's called Mother's Little Helper Monkey.
Yeah, that's my favorite one, I think.
When Brewer first started using dead animals in her art, as a college student at Minneapolis College of Art and Design, it caused a stir. Many people thought her work was morbid and creepy. One professor suggested she see a therapist.
Now we're getting down to the leg.
She ignored him. While other students painted and photographed, Brewer taught herself how to skin an animal, how to mount the hide, how to mummify corpses, and how to preserve the innards. There was a lot of trial and error.
I was making a chupacabra, and it wasn't drying fast enough. And I thought, well, what if I just put it, like, in the oven on low with a fan on it? That wasn't a good idea. It caught on fire. It didn't burn the house down or anything, but let's just say that apartment never really smelled the same again.
In 2004, Brewer hit it big. She and a couple of other rogue taxidermists had their first show at a gallery here in Minneapolis. That exhibit wound up on the cover of the New York Times art section. Suddenly, Brewer was in the spotlight, the face of rogue taxidermy.
I actually was getting emails from people that wanted me to be on television shows and things like that. I'm not a TV person like Jimmy Kimmel, but shows that were approaching me were all just kind of wanted me on the show for the shock value. Like, oh, look at this chick. And she does this like weird, creepy, dead animal art. And I take my work really serious. I didn't want to be associated with that type of thing.
With the publicity came hate mail from people, including animal rights activists, who were offended by Brewer's art.
People that would like threaten my life, you know, like just kind of really mean.
This was particularly heartbreaking to Brewer because more than anything, she's an animal lover. As a kid, she kept bones of her beloved pets on a shelf in her room after they died.
When we'd move around when I was a child, my dad would dig up our pet graveyard and we'd bring the animals with us when we moved to a new place. Inevitably, there'd be something that was like a bone or something. I'd find it.
And her work felt like a continuation of that, a tribute. Brewer emphasizes that she never kills animals for her art, that all the animals are donated and have died from other causes. But that message sometimes gets lost. Art made from dead animals is provocative in our culture, where we tend to restrict death to funeral homes and meat factories, not display it on dining room tables.
Okay, and now we're ready to kind of... The tail is a little tricky. So I'm just going to like hold his body, the base of his tail. I think a lot of kids are taught not to touch things or that death is bad or scary. Wrap a towel around the tail right there. And it just pulls right out like
that. What was your kind of family's attitude around death?
Well, it wasn't, a dead animal wasn't something that was repulsive. It was never like, oh, you know, don't touch that. I think in general, like people in our culture, at any rate, there's just this fear of like what's going to happen to your physical body when you no longer are breathing.
Have you thought about what you want to happen to your body?
Well, when I was like a lot younger, before I got wrinkles, I wanted to have my head freeze dried like a Barbie head, the makeup Barbie head, like, and put it in a case. But then nobody that I was dating wanted to have that in the house. So I kind of gave up on that idea. I'm going to be donating my body to science. It is just a vessel. And when I'm done with it, there's, you know, nothing to, I don't want to be in the ground like with like a rubber body in a coffin. That's for sure.
It worked out just the way I was hoping. Today, Brewer's sculptures sell for thousands of dollars.
So now what we're left with is, you can see the squirrel carcass.
The Geneva Museum of Natural History in Switzerland bought a piece. And so have collectors from around the world.
I'll just say what it is on the bag. I'll just write skinned squirrel.
Other rogue taxidermy artists teach classes around the country based on techniques Brewer helped invent. These days, Brewer's art is celebrated, not vilified.
Put him in the freezer. It's kind of full right now, so hopefully nothing will fall out.
During the holidays, Brewer, her husband, and their other relatives gather in the dining room of their house, surrounded by dozens of mounted monkeys, stuffed crow cats, and two-headed squirrels. And they give thanks.
And our thanks to producer Lila Chernoff for that piece. Coming up, all of us at Word of Mouth circle up to talk about some interesting pieces of audio we've encountered over the last month, whether it's rarely heard music, an entertaining podcast, or kids' music that may not be suitable for kids. The crew discusses what we overheard in April. You can listen in after a short break. I'm Virginia Prescott, and one of the things we love about producing Word of Mouth is encountering interesting sound every single day. We scour record bins and rare tape and the web for the work of independent composers and producers. We find random podcasts, and we discover pieces of music to use for what we call tags and bumps. We have so much fun sharing these bits of lost and found sound among ourselves that we wanted to pass it on to you. So we started a monthly segment that we're calling Overheard. We've got the entire Word of Mouth crew around the table. Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, Taylor Quimby. Maureen McMurray is cueing the sound for us. So with that, let the wild rumpus begin. Taylor, we're going to start with you. What have you got?
Okay, so my special piece of sound, April was National Poetry Month. And so we did a little segment at the end of one of our shows where we wanted to play a poem that would rope in sort of people who don't love poetry very much. And so we picked this funny poem by Billy Collins. It's called Flame.
It is about a deranged Smokey the Bear going into the woods and setting it afire with a can of gasoline. So it's very non-poetry-ish. But while I was doing research, I found this video of a three-year-old kid reciting, by memory, a Billy Collins poem called Litany.
Wow.
So we don't know his name. It's posted by his mom, but here it is.
It starts, Litany.
Litany by Billy Collins. You are the bread and the knife, the crystal goblet and the wine. You are the dew of the morning grass and the burning wheel of the sun. You are the right apron of the bake. Oh, uh-oh.
It's okay.
The marsh birds sunny in flight. However, you are not the wind in the orchard, the plums on the counter, or the house of cards. And you are singing, not the pine-scented air. There is just no way you are the pine-scented air. It is possible that you are the person.
So that is my adorable piece of found sound.
I'm gobsmacked. How does a little kid remember all that?
And that's like, I think the whole video, it's maybe like a minute 50. And he's playing with toys while he's reciting this poem. That was him when he laughs
for
a second.
Yeah, I wondered about that.
He knocks a toy to the ground.
I have to say, I've heard a lot of people recite poems in my life, and not many people are actually good at it. And I mean, I get the point that this is cute and like, oh my gosh, how is he reciting the poem? But the thing that sort of shocked me was he did it really well.
Yeah.
That was actually an excellent reading of a poem. And that's the thing that's like most shocking to me.
Hmm. Okay, well, who wants to go next? Who wants to follow up that little cute kid audio?
Well, mine's not cute at all, so maybe I should.
Oh, Maureen does.
Oh, yeah.
I actually have one thematically that may go with this.
Oh.
So my pick is actually from the Johnny Cash children's album. He produced a children's album in 1975, which I got because I have a little girl and some of the children's music is pretty bad, so I thought Johnny may be able to help out. It was recorded in 1975, and there's a track on it called Old Shep, which was written in 1933 by Red Foley. Now, keep in mind, this is a children's album. The song begins, it's about a boy and his dog and their, you know, wonderful relationship, and then this happens.
But old Shep was right there, to the rescue he came. He jumped in and helped pull me out. Now the years they roll by, and old Shep he grew old. His eyesight at last it grew dim. Then one day the doctor looked at him and said, I can do no more for him, Jim. With a hand that was trembling, I picked up my gun and I aimed it at Shep's faithful head. But I just couldn't do it. I wanted to run. I wish they would shoot me instead.
Kids album.
Like Old Yeller.
Oh my goodness.
Now old Shep is
Johnny
gone,
Cash just can't shade the truth no matter what he does. It's all
and
real.
And no more on this earth will he roam. But if dogs have a heaven, there's one thing I know. Old Shep has a wonderful home.
The ending isn't bad.
Yeah.
The part about I wish that they'd shoot me and I can't play that for my daughter. It's so heavy.
Well, you can now. She's not gonna know what that means.
I know, but man.
And you know, they don't totally know. My I don't know if this story is appropriate for radio, but my son, who is 4, has been talking about our dog, who is 11, and said, "When Angel dies, can we get a turtle?" So, I mean, you know, you got to teach them about death sometimes.
I guess so.
There's a lesson in there.
Yeah, so that's my depressing pick.
My pick is also actually a song about a dog. And this is
from George Coleman. He's an outsider musician, recorded in 1968, known as Bongo Joe. So let me tell you about him. He was born in Florida, I guess, in 1923, so a long, long time ago. And he made his way to Houston like so many people did. It was called Baghdad on the Bayou back in the day. So many African Americans moved there for work. And he was a would-be jazz musician, had no money for a kit, so put together an old oil drum and plays it with mallets. People in Houston actually have spoken to people who said they remember him riding around on his moped with a 55-gallon Texaco, you know, Chief oil drum on the back. And he was a street performer. And I guess Chris Stranowitz from Arhuli Records saw him on the streets in 1968 in San Antonio and decided to make an album with him. So we can hear some of this. Oh yeah, the song is called Innocent Little Doggy.
What is that we see trotting down the street? None other than Innocent Little Doggy. Ain't it cute?
Sounds like it belongs on the next Wes Anderson film soundtrack.
It does.
Wagging his tail in every direction. Up, down, in and out, round and round. He's the cutest little creature. Hush, hush!
Now, I gotta say, like old Shep, this does not end well. Innocent little doggy gets hit by a truck, thrown in a ditch. That's what's interesting about this guy. I mean, all right, it's very satirical. His songs are very, very cutting. Really, but, you know, you can hear the music is actually quite complicated. It's unhinged. I mean, it's like about man's inhumanity to man. It's about the cruel way that we treat each other. And then there's a song called Transistor Radio where, you know, this guy is robbing people at gunpoint for their transistor radio. It's all about greed. But it's an amazing record. And apparently, Arhuli made a CD of it a couple of years ago. And I don't know how well it sold, but, you know, it's kind of become big with the hipster set, you know, the LP people. And every once in a while, there's a run on this record.
Pointed it between the eyes, county clerk. All right, brother.
Is this Transistor Radio?
I think so. They all sound somewhat alike, I gotta say.
They really
shut up, no. Then what? I want that transistor radio.
That transistor radio.
Then I went down to police headquarters. I threw that same 45 between the eyes of the chief jailer. Ah, don't shoot, don't kill me. Here's the key, let every man in the house. I don't give a damn.
It's pretty impressive on the percussion.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's Bongo Joe.
Cool. I like it.
The whole Word of Mouth crew is here sharing our monthly audio picks. I just shared mine. It's from the outsider musician Bongo Joe. So, Molly, what have you got for us today?
So, my piece is from a couple weeks ago where I noticed that the Outside In podcast was getting mixed up with the Outlander podcast.
Outside In, we should say, is NHPR's new show, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And Outlander, which is a show which a zillion people watch.
Right, exactly. Easy to mix up. I don't watch Outlander, but I started listening to this podcast. And I'm going to have to annotate this clip as it plays. And it's in no way affiliated with the Starz show. I cut out their little disclaimer, so I'll say that now.
Outlander set in Scotland. We should let everyone know.
These women are not in Scotland.
Welcome to the Outlander podcast, where the men are kilted, the women are winsome, and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 131 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Welcome to a very special episode of the Outlander podcast, or segment, because depending on the length of this and
this
other
goes
episodes,
on for 46 minutes. Normally they're longer.
To another regular episode. We are going to do a whiskey pod, 100% featuring whiskeys by Doers.
Doers sent them Scottish. This.
We
they have so many sponsors.
This episode is sponsored by Doers. Well, I mean, yes.
It could not have happened without Doers.
Whisker Thurstund, whiskey pods.
Wow, are they just getting increasingly drunk?
No, I'm not trying to channel.
Wait for it.
Channel.
What the
Sean Connery,
heck?
Okay. Let's be honest here. This is our second whiskey.
The first one didn't record.
The first one didn't record. So if
You have any?
Sorry, not sorry.
They have 21,000 followers on Twitter.
Wow. That is what a landscape podcasting has created. That's amazing.
Okay, Logan, over to you, Logan.
Mine has nothing to do with whiskey, but it does have to do with a baby at some point. So this is sort of an inception situation because I heard this piece of sound from a podcast, and that podcast was talking about another podcast. So recently, This American Life did an episode called For Your Reconsideration. And during Act Two, they featured the podcast Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People, which is hosted by comedian Chris Gethard. He's the host of that show. And basically what happens is he opens up the phone line. Someone calls him. He has to talk to them for a full hour. They can hang up if they want to, if they get sick of it, but he can't. He's in it for the whole hour. And so they did this one specifically because Chris was talking to this guy who's a little down on his luck. Like, he's not really living the life that he wanted to live. And so he's telling Chris his story. Chris makes him go back and start at the very beginning of his life. And he tells him that he was actually delivered into this world by Ron Paul.
Mm.
Yeah, so he was delivered by Ron Paul. His mother was released from prison so that she could give birth to him. So he's got kind of a crazy story. And the whole thing, my husband and I were listening to this in the car. And by the end of this, we were screaming at the radio because we were like rooting for this guy so much. But there's, I just want to play a little part where the guy's explaining to Chris Gethard about how he came to be.
There was kind of a different guy I thought was my dad, some balding, redheaded redneck. But my dad was the guy my mom was married to before that.
Uh-huh.
They got married in high school in Montana, moved down to Texas, got divorced, then hooked up 10 years later at the fair.
At the fair?
Yeah, at the fair. And then that's where I came from. I was a carnival baby.
Hold on. You got to give me permission to laugh at the phrase carnival baby.
Because this is very personal.
Thank you so much. This is a personal story, and there's a lot of grim details to it. But you can't use the phrase, yeah, I was a carnival baby, and not expect me to laugh a little bit.
Yeah, no.
Now, when you say they hooked up at the fair, do you mean they saw each other at the fair, remembered their old flame, went back to one or the other's house and had a night of lovemaking to remember the old times? Or are you saying ran into each other at the fair, and then behind the Gravitron, you get conceived?
I think it's more the latter.
Oh, man.
So essentially, Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People is just such a great idea for a podcast. I love the idea of a random stranger calling this guy and him talking him through it. But this one in particular, the story, and I know why This American Life picked it, because it's just such an amazing story, is this guy that we've all been there. He's really having a hard time with life, and he knows he needs to change so many things about his life, and he's paralyzed by the fact that so much needs to change that he can't even change one thing. And so Chris spends the entire hour giving him the most amazing pep talk you've ever heard.
Word of Mouth producers Logan Shannon, Maureen McMurray, Molly Donahue, and Taylor Quimby with me there, offering our monthly audio picks for Overheard. You can find links to hear all of our choices for yourself. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And feel free to share interesting stuff that you've heard recently. You can just go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Thanks for spending some time with us today. We invite you to share what you heard with others. You can just go to wordofmouthradio.org. You'll find a deep list of segments to listen to post on social media, or email to friends. And let us know what you're curious about, those stories and sources that you're finding interesting, or what is scratching at your sense of wonder. We find the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, inviting you to keep on sharing them. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon.
Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.
To me, you couldn't help but see the lies of you and me. You know they couldn't help but be. So crazy.
crazy with love. So crazy with love.